Follow Up North News with our daily newsletter. Go to our website, upnorthnewswi.com, and click newsletter on the top banner. Once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
Welcome to the second hour of Up North News for this Tuesday, September 20th. Coming up shortly, Dan Schaefer from the recombobulation area. We'll find out if things are any warmer and nicer in his part of the state, Milwaukee, than they are up here in Lake Wissota, where the warm front and the storms that were with it have gone through. And now it is, it's a cool morning this morning. Going to be pushing 90, I guess, one last time, but then the cool air sticks around for good. Revolution is a great Beatles song. Revolution is the kind of thing that's necessary against oppressors, something that we learned very well during the coverage of Queen Elizabeth's funeral. There's a tremendous amount of difference between an empire with oppressors versus political disagreements, which we have in the United States. So to ever even intimate that violence is necessary is just wrong. Unfortunately, the right wing in this country has continually increased the level of their frustration that they keep getting outvoted by most moderate Americans to embracing violent rhetoric, to the point where they take a quote from Thomas Jefferson a very, very long time ago and use it to either justify the violence or at least the violent rhetoric, and to then claim that when violence does happen, it's not their fault. In our last hour, we introduced the comments that former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman made at a recent Outagamie County Republican dinner. The same dinner where Tim Michaels spoke, where Eric Toney, the Republican candidate for Attorney General, spoke, where former state Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly, who is now running again for Supreme Court next spring, also spoke. But it was Gableman's remark about Americans getting too comfortable and therefore there needs to be revolution that's been getting attention lately. Fortunately for us, there are people like State Representative Mark Spreitzer from Rock County, ranking Democrat on the Assembly Elections Committee, who, as the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel story about Gableman's remarks notes, has sparred with Gableman, and Gableman has tried so hard to turn that Assembly Committee hearing into a sideshow, into a circus, with his constant trying to talk over, you know, state lawmakers, just the Democratic ones, of course. And Spreitzer notes that Gableman has again demonstrated he is driven by anger. And Spreitzer says he so badly wants approval of far-right extremists. Now that he has lost his taxpayer-funded sham investigation, Spreitzer told the Journal Sentinel, he's stepping up his violent rhetoric even more. This kind of violent rhetoric sadly isn't surprising, but it is still deeply disturbing and absolutely wrong. Either Mike Gableman failed to learn the lessons of January 6th, or he is actively supporting yet another attempt to violently overthrow the government. This is somebody that Robin Voss fired from his so-called election investigation as an embarrassment to Wisconsin. And yet, Luke, as you noted so rightly, this is not an isolated case from Tim Michaels advocating, you know, using a euphemism for mob violence, torches and pitchforks, you know, at the media. Ron Johnson's note that he wasn't scared of the January 6th protesters. He would have been scared if it was a Black Lives Matter protest. Only shows the degree to which, as much as the Republican Party politicians try to come off as, you know, just another disagreement, what they're embracing, coddling, toddling, tolerating, winking at, is something we've not had to deal with in this generation, in this country.
Yeah, and it is it Wisconsin's a purple state. We are going to be deeply divided on a lot of these different political matters, and you would hope that in a purple state that you would have people on both sides of the political spectrum then trying to come together and find compromise, and we're not seeing any of that from Republicans in Wisconsin. They are fully embracing the extreme nature and rhetoric. We're seeing it in Gableman, Johnson, and Michaels. It is a door that Donald Trump opened in 2015, and they are happily walking through it. And there's no signs that there's going to be any moderation from Republicans here in Wisconsin.
No, because, again, under the strategy of muddying the waters, TMJ4 in Milwaukee did a report over the weekend talking to tailgaters about the election campaigns. And everybody's comments that they used were simply that, oh, there's too much fighting, there's too much negativity, rather than there's a lot of violent rhetoric coming from the Republican side. And the Republicans know this. They know that if they're the ones doing most of the dividing, screaming, and, you know, winking at violence, and, you know, progressives, Democrats, centrists all respond, then it takes away from the issues that do matter to voters. They get upset and they either don't vote or, you know, aren't completely familiar with who it is that's causing this violent tinge to our political rhetoric in the first place. Dan Schaefer from the Recombobulation Area will join us after this break. You're up north.
From Lake Wissota, once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
All right, welcome back. This is Up North News for Tuesday, September 20th. And Dan Schaefer joins us from Milwaukee. He writes a column called The Recombobulation Area, named for the famous little, I don't know, what would you call that, 50 square feet of space in the Milwaukee County Airport?
It's that post-security area that everybody gets to put themselves back together, right?
Yeah. How flattering is that? That I noticed people just tweet you pictures now of the Recombobulation Area sign at the airport. And you don't know any of them, but they're tagging you as they post it, thinking of you.
It's some people I know, but some people I don't. It is pretty cool to see people identify my work with the world-famous Recombobulation Area, Milwaukee's own. Milwaukee is home to the only recombobulation area at any airport in the world. So that's, and now I get to be identified with it in my own weird little way. So there we go.
I never seek to be so jealous when people come up with great names for their products, whether it's Recombobulation Area, or I remember when Jesse O'Point at the Cap Times first named her podcast Wedge Issues with a wedge of cheese. And I'm just like, why didn't I think of that? That's brilliant. That's so great. You know,
I knew if I got everything else wrong with this column, that I got the name right. So there you go.
That's right. So Dan joins us, and this is our chance to kind of catch up on some state political issues, but also issues in the Milwaukee area, because we want folks to know, whether you're listening on WRCE in Richland Center, WXCO in Wausau, our other growing network of stations are online, that, you know, the things that happen in Milwaukee do have an impact. In both a good way and in a concerning way about what some of our elected leaders are doing. So, Dan, this week, well, I was going to say there's never any shortage of things to talk about. We're actually going to hold off on the Gableman stuff because we've spent the last couple of segments on his, you know, absolutely horrific references to watering the tree of liberty with the blood of patriots, Thomas Jefferson quote. Though I do have to start by giving you credit that, you know, that Gableman now has a new full name. It's no longer, it's kind of like, you know, the royals have, what is it, Prince Charles Philip Arthur George of Windsor, whatnot. And you note that the former Supreme Court justice's name is now Michael Gableman, who produced no evidence of 2020 election fraud in a $1 million review. I think that's great. That should be on his business cards.
Yeah, I've noticed the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel has been using that more and more in just like every reference to Gableman. So I think that's his full name now. You know, it's like like Game of Thrones when they add the new titles to their names after they have some sort of consequential event happen. That's Gableman's now, so he gets to carry that with him.
Oh yeah, yeah, he gets to own that from this point on. Again, with apologies for stating the obvious, but several of your posts lately have noted correctly that people need to stop so much losing sleep or wailing and gnashing of teeth at the last Marquette poll. Newsflash, we have close races in Wisconsin.
Yeah, we're the most closely divided 50-50 toss-up purple state. And lo and behold, we're going to have some close races. Whether it's a detestable figure like Ron Johnson on the ballot or not, these races are going to come down to the wire. They're going to be extremely close, and we saw that in the polling from Marquette last week. We've seen that in other polling. I think we're just seeing that, you know, beyond the data that we're seeing come in on these races. I think you can use the eye test too, and watch whatever local news broadcast you're watching or whatever Hulu show you've got. You're getting an absolute torrent of ads coming your way. So clearly people are going after those votes in evenly divided Wisconsin.
And yet one of the areas where we're not that evenly divided is, as you have noted, that the Republican candidates today are probably venturing further and further from the mainstream on the topic of abortion and women's reproductive health rights. That is still decidedly not purple about Wisconsin when you ask not just about the right to an abortion, but to exceptions for rape and incest, for example.
Yeah, I think there are many issues upon which Wisconsin is evenly divided. We see that in the Marquette polling. So I write a recap and analysis of every new Marquette poll. So I take a look at all of these different public policy issues that Marquette polls, as well as just the candidates, which I think is something that really sets that poll apart, because they really do pull the issues in addition to the candidates. And one of the issues that has just had overwhelming data is the issue of abortion rights, and especially when it comes to exceptions for rape and incest. More than 80% of Wisconsinites believe that those exceptions should be allowed. That includes more than 70% of Republicans and more than 60% of those who say they are in the quote-unquote very conservative end of the ideological spectrum. So if there's any issue for Democrats to really go all in on in these final 50 days of the election here in Wisconsin, it's that one. And I think it's because of course, the national environment of this, but also the reality of the 1849 law that we have here in Wisconsin that does not allow for those exceptions. And gubernatorial candidate Tim Michaels essentially saying that his policy is the same as that law. The Republican legislature stuck with that law instead of revising it, revisiting it, when Tony Evers called the special session right before Roe was overturned. Democrats are just have everything on their side with the polling on this issue. And I would expect that to be a big time closing message for them, especially with women voters. I think that there's a huge gender gap in Wisconsin politics. That's another piece of the analysis that I wrote this week, is that, you know, the huge divide between Republicans and Democrats oftentimes comes down to a gender gap issue. Women overwhelmingly support Democrats. Men overwhelmingly support Republicans. We're seeing that in the key two statewide races that are happening right now.
You and I have the luxury of being able to put on our amateur campaign manager hats every so often. And so I'm going to ask you to put on yours and seize on the phrase that you said, their closing message on abortion rights, because not every Democratic campaign is making that a centerpiece of their message. Some are hardly bringing it up at all under the same assumptions that it's kind of a third rail and you don't want to talk about it. You might, you know, people might be polarized by it, to which, you know, I'd certainly say the train has left that station. So where I'm curious is to whether that is going to be an increasingly larger part of a closing message? Or are the campaigns that haven't made that front and center, are they giving indications they still don't want to touch it, and that won't be a closing message for them?
Well, I think, you know, I think perhaps it'll be a closing message in some parts of the state, but not others. But I think the polling on this issue is just so overwhelming. I think if you're running for office in this year, as a Democrat, I think you have to be going all in on this issue, because the poll is so overwhelming, and because the national environment, just the history of midterm elections, when you have a Democratic president in the White House, you have the Republican advantage in the midterms. It would be the same dynamic if we had a Republican president in the White House, or Democrats would have the advantage in the midterms. And so I think because of the decision on Roe v. Wade that has made this an atypical midterm election year to a certain extent. And so I think that has to, that big decision by the state Supreme Court that has largely been supported by Republicans, that has to be part of this atypical midterm election year message.
And I also think that it has to be a significant portion of questions that are asked at the forthcoming debates. And we now know that Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes and Ron Johnson are going to debate on October 13th, and Governor Evers and Tim Michaels are going to debate on October 14th. And in the case of both Senator Ron Johnson and Tim Michaels, I will admit a bias, obviously, but I don't feel like they have both necessarily been pressed hard enough to really kind of pin them down on where they stand on things. Michaels has given every indication, without necessarily saying it explicitly, that he would go farther than the current 1849 ban to things that are embraced by Pro-Life Wisconsin, whose endorsement he has sought, and he has answered their questionnaires very specifically. And Ron Johnson, as we talked about yesterday, seems to have been all over the place that he says he's against a national abortion ban, and yet he was a co-sponsor of a national abortion ban. Do you share my belief that, you know, the moderators of this debate simply cannot ask one question and then let it go for both of those gentlemen?
Yeah, especially with Johnson, who's been so all over the place in his responses on this, it's going to be really important to really dig into the details, because we've seen how Johnson will use certain comments to just kind of get the press off his back, which he has admitted to doing. And so he's, like he said last week when he said that the state should have a referendum on abortion, which is, of course, not a thing that the way that laws get made in the state of Wisconsin. It'd be great if it did. We'd have referendums on expanding Medicaid and all sorts of other issues that have been stopped up by the Republican controlled state legislature. But, you know, Johnson has been all over the place with this. Supporting a ban, not supporting a ban. But I was thinking of comments that he made when Amy Coney Barrett was confirmed to the Supreme Court. You'll remember at the time Johnson got COVID and then was saying in the media, and this was, of course, pre-vaccine, saying that he would, nothing would stop him from getting to D.C. to vote for that judge. So, I mean, that the overturn of Roe v. Wade being the key issue in her confirmation. And so he was obviously dedicated to making that happen.
We're talking with Dan Schaefer from the Recombobulation Area. His Twitter handle is Dan R. Schaefer, S-H-A-F-E-R. And I bring it up because so many of your tweets have simply said, your senior senator, Wisconsin, and then it lists something else that, you know, Ron Johnson said or did. And you noted yesterday, Ron Johnson isn't campaigning on any of his accomplishments in his 12 years in the Senate because he hasn't accomplished anything worth campaigning on. And then I saw a follow-up to it that during the Trump years, when Republicans had control for a while, Tammy Baldwin got more bills passed than Ron Johnson did during the Trump years. That, I mean, I'm a cynical old cuss, and even I was caught off guard by that.
Yeah, I was too. Tammy Baldwin, I think there was 35 bills that she had sponsored or co-sponsored to Ron Johnson's 21 that he had co-sponsored or sponsored. This was during the Trump years. This is during the first 2 years of the Trump administration that Republicans had full control. And even then, Ron Johnson got nothing done.
We're talking with Dan Schaefer. We'll continue the conversation after this break. You're up north.
Wisconsin Conversation, real information. Live from Lake Wissota, here is the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
And we're talking with Dan Schaefer from the Recombobulation Area on this Tuesday morning. And we've been talking about some of the big races, and then we'll get into a few local notes as well. We've spent a lot of the time talking about the Senate race, so I want to turn over to the governor's race for a moment here, Tim Michaels versus Governor Tony Evers. Michaels holding a rally on a Sunday in Green Bay about an hour before a Packer game. If that all isn't disqualifying enough, he has Florida Governor Ron DeSantis on, who's now going to be investigated for human trafficking. And we could pick on all of those things, Dan, but I'm going to start with something that's happened since that rally, where Tim Michaels called for all paroles to be halted in the state of Wisconsin, which is not a thing. You can't do that. And I think, Dan, it just tells us that for these final 7 weeks, I think it's still going to be just crime, crime, crime. You know, shots of Kenosha burning, and the Waukesha parade tragedy. And I mean, that's much as people want us to talk about, you know, issues that matter to them, it sounds like they're just going to go full on crime.
Yeah. And you can see the strategy there from the Michaels campaign, trying to win back some of the suburban voters that kind of had moved to the left over the Trump years. And I think, you know, the path and the strategy that Republicans have had historically in Wisconsin is to run up huge margins in Waukesha County, Ozaukee County, and Washington County, the famed WOW counties. We've seen that change in the Trump years. More of the Trump base has been more rural than suburban. But I think there also is a recognition with Republicans in the Michaels campaign that they can't win a statewide race just without winning some of those suburban voters that they've been losing, that they have, the stat that Wisconsin Democratic candidates and Democratic backed candidates have won 10 of the last 11 statewide races. And so I think they really see the suburbs as key to that. And what always plays well in the suburbs is the issue is a tough on crime type of message. And, you know, we'll have to see if that connects the way that it might have in the past. But I think it's clear that Michaels is going to be going all in on that in these final weeks of the campaign to really drum up support in the Milwaukee suburbs. We saw some of the indicators of that in the Marquette poll, that message was landing in the Milwaukee suburbs. He's been campaigning a lot in the city of Milwaukee too. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how that message plays in a statewide race.
Well, certainly one of the things I've said, I think you've said, others have said, is that if he and other Republicans really cared that much about stopping crime in Milwaukee, maybe they would put up a moderate candidate for sheriff who could win or propose some other things other than just, you know, lock them all up. But it's indicative of a dogma of the party that you're going to use the city of Milwaukee as the poster child for all bad things and punish the city of Milwaukee wherever possible. And I think you've been a leading voice out there in trying to spell out the different ways that Milwaukee is being punished by Republicans throughout the state, especially in the legislature, and that it's having a real impact on the city, which is then going to have an impact on the state economy.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, I think one of the big issues that is not being talked about enough in this governor's race is the fact that we have a $5 billion surplus right now. And At the same time that we have this $5 billion surplus, we have local governments all over the state, not just Milwaukee, but all over the state, that are struggling to make their budgets for the next year. Because, you know, we had the ARPA funding is in many ways a lifeline to a lot of these local governments. Milwaukee especially would be out hundreds of millions of dollars without the federal ARPA funding that, let's not forget, the Democrats voted for and Republicans all voted against. And we're seeing this in Milwaukee now because the city is introducing its budget for next year. The county will be introducing its budget later this month for next year. The city isn't introducing it today. And one of the big issues with the city budget is that the city is losing state shared revenue. So the revenue that comes back to the city of Milwaukee from sales and income taxes paid by its residents, it has been cut for more than two decades now. I think, you know, the stat from the Wisconsin Policy Forum said that it's down 47% if you index for inflation. And so the state of Wisconsin is, and what that amounts to is that the city of Milwaukee is out more than $100 million every budget cycle that it should be getting from the state of Wisconsin from the shared revenue. And this budget, especially with inflation being high, is $150 million that the state is not sending back to Milwaukee effectively. And so the way that trickles down with this, the Republican budgetary trickle down cycle, is that Milwaukee is forced to make some really tough decisions. And so I talked to the new budget director for the city of Milwaukee as part of Mayor Cavalier Johnson's administration. I talked to him last week, and he said that there would be cuts across the board, including to police, fire, and public works. And so I believe as we speak, Mayor Cavalier Johnson is introducing his budget to the Milwaukee Common Council. There's been a couple stories around this morning that indeed he is having to make some difficult cuts. And that's because the state of Wisconsin is defunding Milwaukee and starving the city of revenue as it racks up this budget surplus that it is doing nothing with.
It reminds me that Republican Attorney General candidate Eric Toney made a comment that he'd like the State Department of Justice to take over some of the prosecutorial duties, I think, in Milwaukee. And it, again, not a thing. But what you see them doing with the city of Milwaukee is essentially treating them the same as they're treating all public education. You starve it. And then when all the cuts have to be made and when things, you know, there are results from that, you then point to it and say, oh, look how they failed. It's their fault when, you know, you've done everything possible to set them up for failure. And that's what's happening with the city right now.
Yeah, you can't say that we didn't see this coming. Right. You can't say that we didn't see this coming because Tony Evers has proposed changes to state shared revenue as part of his budgets. You know, there's a pretty aligned coalition in Milwaukee County, which of course does include many of the inner ring suburbs as well, on the Move Forward Milwaukee project, which David Crowley has talked about, you know, going back before him, Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley has talked about, many of the mayors and executives throughout the Milwaukee County have talked about that Milwaukee isn't getting its fair share from the state. So its pitch in a lot of ways is to have the state let Milwaukee vote on a local referendum to see whether it wants to raise its sales tax. Not to raise its sales tax, to let Milwaukee decide, to give Milwaukee some level of local control. So Republicans always talk about how they're the party of local control. Not true when it comes to Milwaukee. You know, like you said, you saw the Fond du Lac district attorney who's running for attorney general thinks he knows more about crime in Milwaukee than the folks who are elected to address crime in Milwaukee. And we're seeing the same thing with the legislature, chiefly Robin Voss, saying that Milwaukee is not allowed to raise its local sales tax. And I think, you know, a sales tax is not the ideal form of raising revenue. I think, you know, maybe people would like to see other ways, you know, raise taxes on those, on the wealthy, things like that, that could fund different services. But I think one of the things that local leaders really are emphasizing with this is to get it. It gives Milwaukee some measure of local control over this funds. So whether it's a Republican in Madison, whether it's a Democrat in Madison, making the decisions for us, Milwaukee has one of the lowest levels of local control of any major city in the country. So raising a half cent sales tax increase would mean that Milwaukee would be able to make some of its own decisions on public safety, on transit, on fire, public services, public works, all of these different things that are getting cut in the new budget. But at the same time, you know, we're getting squeezed from all sides, whether it's state shared revenue, whether it's denying local control, whether it's the constant demonization of the state's largest, most diverse city. It's Republicans have put Milwaukee in a very, very difficult spot.
Well, and it is that diversity which appears to be at work in this, and read into my comments what you will. And look, nobody from Milwaukee's paying you to be an ambassador, but I'm going to ask you to anyway. And I've mentioned this before to our listeners that I'm somebody who's been able to live in a couple of the small communities and a couple of the big communities. I've lived in Milwaukee. It has its issues and its problems like any other big city, but not nearly enough is said about what a destination it is and what the quality of life is for many of its residents. It's a fantastic place to be, Dan.
Yeah, it is. It's a wonderful, resilient, amazing city and so much going for it. You know, summer and this time of year is always such an incredible time to be in the city of Milwaukee. So many terrific neighborhoods, so many things that that fly under the radar, especially in the national and statewide political conversation, where people are, you know, I think we're seeing ads. I saw a couple ads this week depicting Milwaukee as a war zone. I live in the city of Milwaukee, and I can look out my front door, and it is not a war zone. There is crime in the city, absolutely, and we want to get a hold on it. You know, we want it, but I think it's also about, you know, using the whole toolbox.
And obviously, again, every place has its issues, but if there's places I wouldn't want to live right now, it's in places that are seemingly guided by hate. You mentioned a school district in Waukesha County that basically wants parents to, you know, wants transgender kids to be outed and discriminated against. There was, you know, in Waukesha County, the debate about ending, you know, school lunch assistance. You had Ron Johnson with an educational forum recently that included a failed candidate from Mequon-Thiensville who was all about, you know, CRT and the evils of it. It's some of those suburbs that are cannot make a case like Milwaukee can about being an attractive place to be right now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't want to speak poorly of the suburbs. I grew up in Waukesha County as well. It has its problems too. I think, you know, this is the story about Arrowhead High School yesterday really reminded me of growing up in Pewaukee and having, you know, certain friends and people who I knew that would be comfortable and free to be who they are LGBT friends and all that, and were not able to necessarily if they were to go home to their Christian parents and all that. So I think, you know, there's challenges that all types of communities are facing, and you know, it's hopefully
and it's something where they could simply learn from embracing diversity the way that Milwaukee and others do. So to wrap up our little visit to the Milwaukee area, if there's one thing that most folks agree on is that they love to come into the city for big events like a Milwaukee Bucks game, especially if you're heading toward the playoffs. Luke knows that I don't follow the NBA as closely as I follow other things. And so I'd hoped Luke was going to give me a really intelligent question to wrap up the final 30 seconds of the segment here. But he's got his Brewers hat on. I see no notes here. So how about if I just toss you this? How about those Bucks?
How about them?
What's your preseason prediction here?
I'm excited. We're about, a little over a month out from the start of the season. Almost exactly. And so I think the Bucks will open their season in Philadelphia. And I think they're going to open up as one of the favorites to win the title. I liken it to, to what the Spurs were under Tim Duncan and Greg Popovich, where they were in contention every year because they have a superstar, Tim Duncan and Giannis Antetokounmpo, and then kind of a similar framework with Monty Ginobili and Tony Parker for the Spurs had for, and now we have Chris Middleton and Drew Holiday for the Bucks.
I could definitely handle that. I could handle that kind of reputation that goes for years. Dan Schaefer, it's always fun. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a great day. We will wrap up this hour's conversation right after this break. You're up north. Welcome back. It's Tuesday morning. This is Up North News. I'm Pat Freitlow. The Brewers did not fare well, shall we say, and maybe farewell is what we're going to end up saying to them at this point. Max Scherzer was perfect for six innings, and the Mets will Mets and Brewers will try again this evening at 6:40. And then 1:10 on Wednesday, and then it's off to Cincinnati for the final road trip of the season. And we will, I guess, see. There's still enough time for the Brewers to get into the wild card, but they've really the bats have to be more consistent. There, like I said, there were some fun games against the Yankees on Friday and Saturday, but it kind of reminds me about the way I tied this to, you know, the Tony Evers approach toward Main Street business grants, you know, a bunch of small business grants instead of one great big Foxconn thing. Because if you swing for the fences a lot, you're going to strike out or fly out all the time. And that is literally what is happening to the Brewers. It's great to have that many home runs. It's a lot of fun, but it does mean, you know, you can't play the small ball game and, you know, score runners from scoring position here. And that's just, you know, I don't know, guys, you got a few more games to figure it out. And that's just to get into the wild card round of things.
Yeah. And the wild card series set up this year is going to be three games for the higher ranked wild card team as well. So it's going to be an away series for the Brewers because there's no way for them to capture home field advantage. So they've got their backs against the wall right now, but there's still a chance. 2.5 games is not insurmountable.
No, not yet.
We're now chasing Philly, not the Padres, because the Padres leaped over Philly with the results of their games yesterday. So now we're hoping for Philadelphia to not play up to standards, and we're hoping that we can get some wins here, lining up these last few series.
So when last we left the 3rd Congressional District race, Derek Van Orden was rejecting the typical debate format, which, you know, has been well established. Reporters ask, you know, good, well-researched questions, and that way we can learn more about the candidates. And Van Orden said, no, he wants a town hall style, which we know he wants that to be more of, you know, something that's rather raucous and with, you know, rather simplistic questions. And so we thought it might be all done, but Lawrence Andrea from the Journal Sentinel has put up a note that Brad Paff has said, okay, let's try something. It says he's passed along a statement from the Brad Paff for Congress campaign, has renewed its call for three debates across the state and proposed this outline. Three town hall style debates, one in La Crosse, one in Stevens Point, one in Eau Claire. So, you know, again, the major cities of the congressional district. The events should be moderated, which is consistent with debates with this format, with audience questions submitted and asked through the moderator, who has the discretion to decide which questions will be asked. The local media in each of these areas should be invited to attend and participate to maximize the number of voters in the 3rd Congressional District who will hear directly from the candidate. Well, having seen that now for the first time, I can say with complete confidence that Van Orden will say no, and there will be chicken clucking sounds in the background, but it is, you know, simply not enough for audience members to submit their questions and ask them through a moderator. He's hoping for, you know, those viral moments where, you know, audience members will ask something that is completely outlandish or based on misinformation. And again, in the time it takes to correct the misinformation, there's, you know, no longer time for it to answer the question, or Brad Paff will look like he's on defense, or Derek Van Orden will say, yeah, he's right, even though the moderator might say, no, actually, that's not right. The whole thing could turn into a free-for-all. And that's not a debate. That's a TV show. It's a reality show. I have said before, I'm not in favor of any live audiences debates. And it goes all the way back to when Lloyd Benson turned to Dan Quayle and said, I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no John Kennedy. And, you know, the audience went wild with applause. And I thought it was a great gotcha line, too. I did. But it completely showed why you don't want to do that in front of a live crowd. This is not Jerry Springer, you know, or whatever show you prefer to watch these days where the crowd gets all raucous. This is serious business. This, as we heard earlier from Hans Breitenmoser, this determines what kind of policy our farmers will have. Our farmers were really hurt in the early years of the Trump administration because rather than focusing on Wisconsin farmers, Trump went for the easy talking point of, you know, let's take it to China. Let's hit China. All that did was hurt our farmers. And China simply went to other countries that also grow soybeans and other products that we would ship to them. That's how the market works. And, you know, guys like Trump who talk about the magic of the marketplace, they know this at the time, but they're looking for the easy points. And so that's what I'd like to see avoided in these final 7 weeks. The election is 7 weeks from today. And it would be so refreshing if we could just get those two in a room. But as you know, from the soundbite that we played from Capital City Sunday, that's what they tried to do. They just tried to get nice, quiet, issues-based interviews with both Brad Paff and Derek Van Orden. Brad Paff said yes, just like he did for us, you know, gave exact answers rooted on policy, on growing jobs in the district, on growing, you know, local manufacturing as a way to help the supply chain. And then you heard the anchor say afterwards, we reached out to Derek Van Orden, but they said he couldn't fit it into his busy schedule or whatever the case may be. And so consequently, no Van Orden to give even a simple interview.
And it's a similar result, I believe, is going to be expected from the Main Street Alliance. It's trying to put together some roundtables between members of in the 3rd District and have those small business owners be able to ask questions to both State Senator Brad Paff and Derek Van Orden. And it seems like there's crickets there. So hopefully we'll get an update from Sean Fetteplace from Main Street Alliance later this week when he joins you on air. But just avoiding the general public and then only going and doing media appearances where you see fit is not a way for somebody to run for Congress, in my opinion. And it's upsetting to believe that this strategy could work in a coin toss 50-50 district.
It is unfortunate because, you know, as Dan Schaefer noted as well, you know, money talks. And right now, if you've got enough money to run the campaign ads that you want to run, and if you can, again, make a lot of, you know, voters who don't pay attention to politics, make them think that, you know, just both sides are equally negative with each other, you know, then you can hopefully play the odds and swing an election in your favor without having to answer any tough questions. We know that TV debates are not the most highly rated things that are out there, and the ratings would be even lower if they listened to me and didn't allow live audiences, but they're still vital. And I would hope that the media outlets in the 3rd Congressional District continue to push anyway, because that's what their viewers deserve. More in our next hour. You're up north.